About the what? What?
Man, I'll call you back.
Oh, man.
Sounds like another case of flu FOMO. Don't get stuck at home with the flu. A flu shot is safe, effective, and you can get it at the same time as your COVID-19 vaccine. A flu shot is the best way to prevent the flu and its potentially serious complications. It keeps you protected and also protects your loved ones. Protecting our community can't wait. So why get stuck inside with the flu? Don't get flu FOMO. Learn more at getmyflushot.org.
Brought to you by the AMA, CDC, and the Ad Council.
This is KPFT, FM, and HD1 Houston.
Welcome to So What's Your Story, the only show in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and you're going to find it only here on KPFT, Houston HD1, Houston's community station, 90.1 on the dial, or kpft.org for the rest of the world. I am Hank Rubicek, producer of this award-winning show, where each week we, with the best team on radio, we place the spotlight on ordinary people with extraordinary stories to tell. The team, Mary Edgerton, Eric Heen, Larry Thompson, and I want to start off by thanking all of you who donated during this last fund drive. Your generosity helped us reach our goal. And to everyone, donors or not, thank you for your support and for your love of story. September, fall. And is there anything more uplifting than the start of a new school year? Crisp air, leaves falling. Only in our fantasies, huh? But yes, lots of things are more uplifting, unfortunately. Maybe a quick explanation rests in Bob Dylan's "Times There Are A-Changin'." I remember school supplies being a big deal, getting over summer crushes and fueled by youthful optimism, looking forward to new ones, hoping to get popular teachers and praying I don't end up with the pitiful ones. Rejuvenation, anticipation, expectation, all good. Safe, secure, a feeling you were too cool for school. Now, not enough teachers to educate our kids. Rundown classrooms, security issues, lockdowns, guns, getting rid of libraries. Instead of anticipating good things, many of us expect the bad and prepare for the worse. Of course, school's positive landscape still exists. It's just more difficult to find. But we'll be treated tonight by a story like we're going to call Starting College. It's sort of a series in a way, and it's going to be told by veteran guest, season teller, and dear friend, Paul Topekian. Paul, again, for the 100th time, thank you for being here.
Hank, it's so wonderful to be back here
We don't do a lot of shows. We don't do a lot of shows in the studio. I mean, even though it's been around a while, a lot of people still do stuff at home, and I'm really pleased that you are here. And Rico is running the Borsa Note. Rico Enriquez, a former student and actually an employee of KPFT, we can say.
Yeah,
right?
People are probably
paying
tired
you $3.11 an hour, right, yeah. For the 9 hours a week. My God.
I got a hat.
What else could you want? You are great. Thank you for being here. Okay. Now, college was so great for many of us. It's a different start of a school year. It's exciting as hell. Your experience, Paul, was not only unique, but really inspiring. Without giving too much away, your college story portrays a true gift that keeps on giving. First, tell us where you went to school and the years you attended.
So I went to this very small private liberal arts school in central Illinois. Now, I'm originally from New York, and this school, when I say small, we're talking 500 students.
Wow.
And the time period, we're going back 50 years, Hank, yeah. 1973.
Right.
Matter of fact, 1973... this month,
yeah,
it's kind of scary.
Yeah, it is scary. I'll tell you what's even scarier. The scarier thing is that I'm older than you, and I started college in 1970, okay? I just want our listeners to know that we're not that old. When Paul and I were in college, we did have history departments. I just wanted everybody to know. I thought that was pretty funny. I don't know. Okay, good. Now, Your story is in three parts, sort of like an HBO special, but we don't have to tune in next week. Now, tell us the first part.
Okay. What I'm going to do, guys, is I'm going to take you from Yonkers, New York, to Carlinville, Illinois. And let me tell you, it was a long trip. I'd been offered a ride to college by Gordy and some friends, some upperclassmen that I would be joining. And they came and picked me up in a van one morning. It was late August. We were heading south on the Henry Hudson Parkway. If you know New York, that's diving into Manhattan and heading over across the George Washington Bridge and into New Jersey and then on into Pennsylvania. We were driving to this small college in the middle of nowhere. Back in the day, when you were going to college, if you were going out of state like I was, you might not have ever even seen where you were going. There wasn't the internet. You might have had a brochure, and you probably looked on a map, and that's what I did. And this town was in what seemed like the middle of nowhere. The trip took better than 19 hours, and the sun went down while we were on I-70 in Ohio. And I had really never been more than maybe 30 miles west of the Hudson River, so this was all new terrain for me. As we drove through the night, we went through Indiana and then on into Illinois, and things became stranger and darker, and the road became straighter and straighter, and the scenery, well, there pretty much wasn't any scenery. The final probably 50 miles was as if we were on a one-lane highway with nothing but grass on one side, a ditch, the road, grass, and more ditch. And oh yeah, on the other sides of the ditch, there was corn, lots of corn. And it was dark, kind of cue that music, the twilight zone, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, where are we going? We finally got to the college at about 3 in the morning and piled out of the van and into the dorm and found some rooms that we could crash in. And it was in the morning the next day that I woke up and I stepped outside and realized that I was definitely not in New York anymore. And I wasn't in Ohio where the sun had gone down. Nope, I was in central Illinois. There were no curbs. There were no cars. There was no sound of cars. Everything was flat. And there were, as best as I could tell, no people. Okay, now you're probably sitting there thinking, well, what's the big deal? You knew that you were moving from a big city to a small town. You should have known all of this. And you're right. I knew that. On a certain level, I knew that. But on another, I really had no clue. And hold that thought, because you're going to find that cluelessness, well, let's say it's a reoccurring theme in this story. There were a lot of things that were very, very strange about that city and about Carlinville in general. First of all, I was able to walk into town from the outside of town to the square, which, by the way, was actually a square. And I went to buy a fan for my dorm room because it had no AC. When I walked into the store to buy the fan, the clerk looked at me and said, "You must be from the college." And I looked at her and was, "How do you know I'm from the college?" And she said, "Well, you have a very strange accent and you don't look like you're from here." And that was really the first time that I realized that I had an accent at all, and it sort of scared me a bit that people could easily look at me and say, "He's not from here." The town, as I said, was kind of strange in the way it was laid out. New York streets and roads run everywhere. Unless you're in Manhattan, everything is by the contour of the land. But in Illinois, there is no contour to the land, so everything is just laid out on a square. The streets had names such as East First North. That's where the hardware store was. And then there was West Main and East Main and North Broad and South Broad. There was an East Second South. And then they had all of the trees covered. They had elm, cherry, plum, pine, cedar, you name it. They had a street. And there was a whole section in the town where all of the houses looked the same. Well, not every house looked the same. Every third house looked the same. And that turned out to be because they had all been bought from a Sears catalog by the Standard Oil Company back in 1920. I really felt like I was in a completely different place. The woman at the hardware store chatted me up a bit. I told her I was from New York. And when I was finally checking out to pay for my fan, she said, "Oh, don't worry. We don't charge tax to the college students." I was like, okay, this is very strange. I went on to my next place, which was the bank. I needed to open a banking account. And in the bank, I had another one of these strange experiences. The clerk who was signing me up for my checking account spent 20 minutes talking to me about where I had come from and what I had seen on the way, which I told her was not very much because it was dark and everything was flat. But she wanted to know about New York, and I tried to explain it to her, and I think she wanted to be there, even though I thought I wanted to be where I was. The bank had a very interesting thing. I got a checking account, but they had no checks to give me, and they said, don't worry about it. When you go into a store, you'll find that there are blank checks sitting on the counter. All you have to do is fill your name in and an account number and write a check, and it'll go through. And that became a problem later on in life when I would go to the bar at night and buy drinks and sign counter checks and not be able to reconcile my checking book at the end. And when I say small town, I mean really small town. The phones were small town. You didn't have to dial anything but the last four numbers to reach somebody. You didn't need an area code and no prefix. Just dial the number. Nobody locked their doors, and everybody left the keys in their car. And one of the strangest things at all was that there were parking meters on the square and near the courthouse. But get this, you don't put money in the meter. In Carlinville, you leave it on the dashboard, and the meter man puts the money in the meter for you. This was one strange place, but I have to say that after a couple of 3 days, I was beginning to enjoy it.
Okay. Now, you're right. The idea of listening to this may not be all that spectacular to the novice ear, but the idea of going from a really large city to a small town to a college is a transition that most can't possibly fathom because you're experiencing things that you never thought ever existed. So, for example, I would imagine that being from New York, when you see corn and cows, those two items are pretty frightening in and of themselves.
Indeed.
Because corn comes from a can. It doesn't come from a stalk, right?
Truly.
Stalking in New York City means you're stalking somebody. It doesn't mean there's corn.
It's true. And the thing that was truly scary was the notion that I was walking around like a marked man because people would look at me and go, he's not from here.
Right. Yeah. And cows. Come on. I mean, look, don't misunderstand me. I understand that all of these things matter. I understand that, you know, I studied the Gemeinschaft Society in sociology. I know that the rural life is a wonderful life. I know it's quiet. I know it's secure. But, you know, in my mind, it's really very dangerous. It's totally dangerous. I mean, that's where Children of the Corn comes from, right? Have you ever seen that movie? I mean, Stephen King had it all together. As far as I'm concerned, Children of the Corn is exactly what we experience in Nebraska. I'm sure that I'm insulting thousands of people right now who come from Nebraska. I sure I am. But, you know, what can I tell you? Growing up in a city is a very, very unusual experience for many. So, for example, if you say to me, get me a wrench, I would say, well, isn't that where cattle are raised, right? To me, I mean, what exactly does that mean, right? Okay, so I just wanted to set the landscape because that's what you're doing here. You're giving us a rural landscape. You're from New York. All you've seen are brick buildings, concrete, people, masses of them. That's all you've seen. And now you're going on the opposite side of the continuum to a rural setting where you have change on the dashboard where the cop who's about to give you the ticket will say, I don't want to give him a ticket. I'm going to open the unlocked door, get change, put it in the meter so that Paul can have a nice rest of the day. Well, is that what you're saying?
And you didn't even need to leave the door unlocked because you just left your window rolled down.
So
because in Carlinville, it never rained.
Okay. All right. It never rained.
I'm joking.
Okay. Okay. So we're not in Kansas.
It was a strange. We're not in Kansas. We were not in Indiana and not Ohio. We were in a very, very strange place. And it would get a little bit stranger because things you take for granted and things you assume, they all go out the window.
And I also wanted to tell our listeners that Sears, as in Sears Roebuck, really did sell houses. Honest to God, they sold houses.
Oh, absolutely.
They were in their catalogs. So, Rico, you could buy underwear, you could buy socks and a house and put them all in your cart.
You could buy two.
Wanted to let you
there were no carts. You had to write it down on a piece of paper.
You had to write it down, call an operator who actually spoke English and took your order, and your house could be there in a week.
And could you imagine somebody receiving that order form and looking at it and seeing that it has 150 houses, 50 of these style, 50 of these style?
Right. You had choices.
It was very strange.
You did have choices.
It was very strange.
Okay. Let's continue.
Okay. This is sort of the be careful what you wish for segment. Colleges in the early and mid-70s were packed. Today, there's not enough students to fill colleges, but back in the 70s, the Vietnam War was going on, and college was a place to be. And so finding a place to room was challenging, and Blackburn was no exception. The dorms were totally packed. I didn't get along with my assigned roommate. Now, this is a little bit strange. You may not pick up on this, but my name is Paul Topikian, and it ends in IAN, and that means that I'm Armenian. And for some reason, the housing folks at the college had put me in a room with the only other person from that part of the world who was a Turk. Turks and Armenians do not get along, given the fact that they were massacred by the Ottoman Empire back in the 1915s up to the 1919. Well, who should my roommate be? What, Marwan Kumbarji? And the two of us looked at one another. Now, clearly, there's no reason why two people that have never met should not get along with one another simply because one's Armenian and one's Turkish. But lo and behold, we did not. And before we tried, well, I just booked. I took my Fran, and I took a chair that I had bought, and I went looking for a new roommate. And this was tricky because, as I said, there was really no space, and I was explaining my plight to a group of students that I had met when one girl, Barb, said, "Oh, I have a spare bed in my room. My roommate's staying with her boyfriend in the butler dorm. He has a single." And I didn't ask, but I was thinking, well, if he has a single room, you know, why can't I room with him? But I thanked Barb for the offer, and ultimately I ended up moving in with her. Now, Blackburn was co-ed, but the dorms were not, and there were visiting hours, but it didn't seem like it really mattered. Barb's room was at the end of the hallway, right near the fire escape, and it was easy for me to duck in and out. The other girls on the floor, they just treated me like I was someone's little brother. It was the second weekend that I was at college when things continued to happen that I thought were kind of strange. A group of us had gone into town for pizza, and I was surprised to see that they did not sell slices, only whole pies. And their whole pies did not have slices either. They just took a round pie and they cut it up in a square. This made no sense. If you're from New York or from the Bronx, you do not serve a round pizza in squares. You just don't do that. I didn't really know what to think. And this was not the only thing that didn't make any sense. I went into the store that I had gone into, an electronics store that I had purchased some tubes for my amplifier. I had a bass amp that I had brought out. This is back in the old days when amplifiers had tubes. Four of them had broken, and I had bought three, and it was pretty loud with three, but I needed the fourth. And when I went back, I walked in, and there was a bag on the counter, and it said, "For the black-haired boy from Blackburn." I thought that was kind of strange. It had my tube in it, and the stranger part, that it had my change. They had overcharged me for the first three tubes, and they had left the money that they had overcharged me sitting in a bag. Who would do that back in Yonkers? Well, back on campus, I was invited by Barb and some of her friends to go swimming at the coal mine lake. I've never been to a coal mine, and know they had lakes. Some of the guys from Butler were going too, and I knew who they were. "Do I want to go along?" I said, "Sure." So we got there. I got out there first. There was a spot that had been made kind of, the coal mine lake was a man-made lake, and it had trees that ran right down to the water. But in this one area, that somebody had dumped sand, and there was a fire pit, and there was a table that you could sit at. We got there first and piled out of the car. Now, the only place that I had ever gone swimming before, other than county pools and beaches, was, of course, the YMCA. And when you go to the YMCA or a public pool, you wear bathing suits. And that was the assumption that I was working under. And that turned out to be an assumption that was erroneous, because as soon as we got out of the car, the girls' clothes started coming off faster than I could imagine. Sneakers and tops came off, then shorts and panties, and all of a sudden I was standing open-mouthed next to three naked girls. They made their way into the water, and I was frozen in panic. I had never seen a naked body in 3D much less three of them at the same time. I had seen them in 2D in magazines, but I had no idea. What I had seen were these photos, and this was not them. It was not the case that I would know what to do, run or hide, strip or dive. And there was another problem that was brewing, so to speak, the natural reaction that a 17-year-old male has when he's suddenly finding himself in the presence of naked women. How to get into the water without being detected? Were they looking? Did they care? And the bigger question was, if they were looking and they saw, well, what would happen next? Laughter? I had no idea. I was clueless. But I opted for quick action and was out of my shorts and into the water as quickly as possible. The water was nice, it was warm, and thank God it was slightly cloudy, so our submerged bodies were not in clear view. The Butler guys never showed up, and ultimately it was just the four of us, me and three girls, paddling around in the coal mine lake. After a while, that seemed to be a bit normal. They didn't seem to be interested in me, and, well, I was certainly interested in them, but it wasn't showing as much. Ultimately, it was time to go. We got dressed, headed back to campus. And as I was getting out of the car at the dorm, Jan, who was driving the car, suggested that we better go in and check for ticks. And she said, I think I saw one on Paul. Not knowing what a tick was or how you check for them, I missed the import of this comment. But the other girls didn't, and they started giggling. Went back to the room, and Barb told me to go take a shower and where to check, and I did. No ticks. Now, the custom on the floor was, when there was a male there, when you walked on the floor, you would yell, "Man on!" And if you were in the bathroom, what you would do is hang a blue towel on the door. And that way girls would know that there was a man in there and that they should not enter. Well, somebody did enter, and it was Barb. And suffice to say, it was the second time that I saw a naked body. She came in to make sure that I had no ticks, and I had no ticks. And despite my cluelessness to the whole want-to-go-swimming invitation, I knew what was coming next. But there was a problem. We lacked an essential item. We didn't have any condoms. The idea of running around a dorm wearing a towel looking for condoms is not going to work.
That's an interesting sight, Paul. I'm trying to close my eyes and envision that. It's not a pretty picture. You're right. It's not a pretty picture.
It was a bit scary.
Yeah. You know, Rico, you're sitting there. You're very attentive, and I appreciate that. You're being an active listener.
Yep.
You're a gainfully employed college graduate. Well... You're a college graduate. Okay. Now, what is your take on Paul's excursion?
I mean, when he started talking about the events unfolding and unclothing, I cheered audibly. Yeah.
You did. You really did.
Sounds like a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Something you'd want to see, yeah.
Something I'd want to experience.
Right, right. Have you experienced life in a small town? You know, have you experienced any life in a small town?
Just a few speeding tickets in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, well, you know, there was a thief in a small town who stole all the toilets, and the police issued a statement saying they had nothing to go on. I just wanted you guys to hear that. Yeah. This is Hank Rubicek celebrating the start of school with a special spotlight on college with my friend and guest teller, Paul Tabikian, on So What's Your Story on Houston Station, Houston's community station, KPFT HD1. 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Before we get back to Paul in just a few minutes, I want to talk about ways of getting involved with the storytelling thing. It starts by finding a support and friendly group, a very supportive and friendly group. And I happen to know the perfect one. It's our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. We meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. The next swap is September 24th, I believe. So get the Zoom link at www.houstonstorytellers.org. And while you're there, check out our event, Skyline Screamers, which is on October 21st, 7:30 at Marmion Park, 18th and Heights Boulevard. How much does it cost? Well, can you say free? But we do take tips, and we love it if you became a member. I can't talk price, but you probably have enough lodged in the cracks of your sofa to pay for an annual fee. You can also take your skills to the next level by joining the Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network. Also, our friends at The Moth meet up at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month with a kaleidoscope of human narratives. It's a great date night, or maybe a great place to find a date. I don't know. Get tickets online because they go fast. Paul, you've been going to The Moth, right?
Yes, last night.
Right? And how was it?
It was very, very good.
Yeah. I know it's difficult to explain to a group of listeners who wasn't there, because they have a bar, so most people are drunk an hour in. But it's competitive storytelling, right? We want to say that word loosely, because the best stories don't always win, obviously, but it's an opportunity to tell some personal narratives that deal with a certain theme, specific theme. What was the theme yesterday?
The theme yesterday was driven.
Driven. Okay, quick. You took this course, Rico. If you had to come up with a story with the theme driven?
I couldn't remember. Not any fault of yours, but it's been a while.
Uh-huh. Okay, but driven. What do you think of when you think of driven?
Again, driving, back to the speeding tickets.
You drive
a lot
what?
Of those. Speeding tickets?
Speeding tickets, yeah. Okay. So you tell, okay, good. It's a prompt.
Okay.
That's the you heard the word prompt. Okay, I'm just checking. Very good.
I remember.
So, yeah. But The Moth is a great place to go. It really is. I was there in March of 2020, and that was the last I was there because I caught COVID there.
Sitting
next to you, but I can't blame you. But nevertheless, almost died. But other than that, I have great memories of The Moth. I will go back eventually because it is a lot of fun, and The Moth has been great to this show. They have always been great, you know, wonderfully supportive, and they always, always endorse us. Now, let's do a quick synopsis of what we got so far. Okay, you're on your way from New York. You're on your way to a little town in Illinois. You've painted a very mysterious, intriguing, and, a rather simplistic landscape, but nevertheless, one that is entirely different to you. And you get there, and you have a roommate with whom you are less than satisfied, right?
Yes, indeed.
And what are some other things we should fill in before you tell us this third part?
Well, I think what I would say is that the perplexedness that one has when you're faced with something that you didn't really anticipate can be challenging. And then, you know, obviously one of the things that's problematic is how do you respond? What do you do? One of the things that's not clear in the story is that I was deeply in love with a woman back in New York, my girlfriend Eileen, and here I was all of a sudden about to go down a slippery slope.
Yeah. You know, one of the things, it doesn't sound very profound, but it's true. The idea of living on campus is a variable most people don't experience much anymore, and how much you learn in doing so, right?
And
I mean, it's quite remarkable.
Back in the day, living on campus was literally, for us, living on campus. We didn't really leave. We couldn't. I went to college. I left in August, and I didn't get home until Christmas time. You know, I spent the entire semester in Carlinville, Illinois, with the exception of a trip to Chicago. And so, you were in a small little universe.
You really didn't want to go home, actually.
I was very happy to be
really
away from parental supervision.
You didn't want to go home. Now, there are more lessons than you can count in your story. But if there's one single takeaway so far for our listeners, regardless of age or educational background, what would that lesson be so far?
I think it would be careful what you wish for.
Be careful what you wish for. Okay. It's always an adage, isn't it? It's always an adage.
Well, it's true to a degree. Yeah. I mean, you know, people think about things, and then when they happen, they're like, oh, my God, that thing happened, and I really wasn't ready for it.
Right. All right. That's right. Well, give us the climax.
Okay. Well, after looking around for condoms. We ended up at the drugstore.
Oh, you left off at condoms. How could I forget? I'm sorry.
We needed those because we couldn't consummate the rest of the story when there'd be no climax. No, actually, it was an anticlimax.
Okay, great. I like that.
Have you ever had a pharmacist ask you what size condom you need to buy?
No, I never had that good fortune.
I did, and I had no idea what to say, and I said mediocre, and I think that's what, at the end of the day, Barb would have said. But anyhow, let's take it on.
All right.
Let's take it on.
Yeah.
That's a segue.
So as you're aware, I'm sure, sex and feelings of attraction and longing can be, they can add a lot of complexity. Especially if you're having sex with someone who's not who you really want to be having sex with or thought you would. In my case, it was Eileen, and her birthday was approaching, and here I was sleeping with Barb in Illinois. I was very conflicted, but unfortunately at that point, not enough to have stopped sleeping with Barb. I'd walked over to Butler. I was kind of in a funk, the dorm where I was supposed to be rooming, to call Eileen, and I really didn't know what I was going to say to her. I went to use the payphone, but it was in use, so I went down to the parlor to get a Coke from the soda machine. And as I was getting a Coke, I realized things needed to change in my life. I was living a lie. You know, it was really kind of weighing on me. And I was at that moment, kind of in the midst of sorting out my love life, that I got my hand stuck in this Coke machine. You see, among the many things that I had learned and experienced in that first couple of weeks, I went to Grateful Dead concert. I'd end up one morning in a strange dorm room with a newly pierced ear, was that I had also been taught by the master, Mike Butzo, how to finesse Cokes out of a Coke machine. This basically entailed sticking your arm up inside the dispenser and pushing the stack of bottles upward and then twisting the bottom one about 90 degrees so that it would just point down and then you could pull it out. And it's just a matter of sliding it out. My hand was relatively small, and I had a thin wrist, and I was really, really good at this. I had perfected the technique. I could pull out six Cokes with no problem. The problem this time, however, was the stack that I had picked had too many bottles in it, and as I pushed up, I had slipped my hand, and it was pinned. And the more I struggled, the tighter it got. We tried rocking the machine to see if that would kind of loosen things up, and we put in 15 cents to see if it would dispense my hand, but none of these things worked, and I was forced at that point in time to sort of fall on my sword and have someone go and find the guy with the key who loaded the machine. This would no doubt get me in trouble with the dean, but, you know, attempted theft of a bottle of Coke valued at 15 cents, I figured it was probably something I didn't have much choice. But unfortunately, no one could find him. He was probably up at the bar somewhere. It spent 2 hours kneeling in front of this Coke machine, and that's a long time. And there weren't that many interruptions. I mean, occasionally folks would come down and they'd want to get a Coke, but they couldn't because my hand was there. Some people came down and offered advice on what they thought they could do to get my hand out, and others just came down to laugh at the poor freshman who had his hand stuck. Sitting there was like sort of being in the stocks at the Boston Commons. Everybody would come down and look at you like, you poor schmuck. During that time, my mind had a lot to think about, and it kept coming back to the implications of having lost my virginity and my girlfriend Eileen, who was the love of my life, and unfortunately I didn't lose it with her despite all of my previous best efforts. But, you know, she was back in New York and I was here in Illinois, and I had been with this older woman. She was 20, I was 17, and it felt bad. In addition to losing my virginity, I experienced, how to say, other delights. But, you know, over the next 5 weeks, I came to realize that, you know, sex and love are two different things, and love was much more important. But there is a problem. I was kneeling here for 2 hours, and I needed to pee. I needed to pee really badly. And there weren't very many options. Somebody came along and suggested that maybe I should use one of the Coke bottles, but I thought that would be problematic. You know, it's one thing to have your arm stuck in a Coke machine, but it's another to be found exposing yourself to a Coke machine, and I'm sure that would lead to discipline well above what just trying to steal a Coke would be, and I would never hear about the end of it. It's a small campus. So we decided we would go with the nuclear option. The nuclear option basically was that we would tip the machine over on its side. That would loosen the weight. And if that didn't work, we were going to tip it up top. That would clearly work. And just as we were about to do that, the guy with the key showed up, thankfully. He opened the machine, I got my hand out, and then I had to go talk to the dean. Basically, it was kind of downhill from there. He told me to stop being an idiot. He didn't say it exactly that way, and I said I would stop being an idiot. That didn't stop me ultimately from flunking out of school at the end of my freshman year, but I must say that I swore off Coke and switched over to cream soda, and I stayed faithful to Eileen to the end of that year, which was when she dumped me. I was back in Yonkers at that point. I had flunked out, and I was driving a forklift, and I wasn't much fun, and it seemed to me that she had somebody else that was interested in her who was clearly more enticing. It didn't last. We saw each other on and off after that, but, you know, what I can say in the end is everything worked out, you know, rather nicely. She's happily married. I'm happily married to other people. And 50 years later, we still laugh and talk about this. And I've had a good friend for quite some time, despite my bad acts.
Not to mention the fact that in the early 70s, you give a whole new meaning to giving up Coke. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I guess.
It was a lot easier to give up then than it wasn't in the 80s, that's for sure.
Now, I want you to think about this, because on a very serious, very, very serious note, you are wonderful at this college, and I want our listeners to know what you've been doing to really cultivate and make sure that not only your college, your alma mater stays alive, but you really do a lot of wonderful things for education. We're going to get that to in just a moment. But right now, I just want people to ask themselves the question: how do you know that you've been at college too long, Rico? How do you know you've been at college too long?
When you work with your professor a few years after you graduate.
Okay, it's when your parents run out of money.
Yeah, I just that thought, too.
Okay, all right. why did the son skip college? Anybody know that?
Oh, I don't know. That's a tough one.
Well, because it already had a million degrees. Right. 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 And what did the buffalo say to a son when he left college?
You're stumping me. You're stumping me.
Bye, son.
Bye, son.
Yeah.
You know, I saw Bison this summer.
Did you really?
Yeah. He was waving at his father.
See, that would scare me. Why would you? I mean, a bison, it's a big animal.
I did. It was a big animal. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know what used to scare me most about living out in the country? I taught at a great school, Hamilton College, for a year. Many listeners, I'm sure, know it. You probably know it. It's in Clinton, New York. When I got there, all they asked me is, have you seen The Sterile Cuckoo? You know, come Saturday morning. Yes, because that's where it was filmed. But what really scared me to death about driving to school every morning was that I was always behind a truck with hay in it. And I would always have these nightmares that the hay would come out of the truck, bury my little Plymouth Horizon at the time, and no one would ever find me in the snow squall of upstate New York.
So
that was my frightening experience.
A scary thing in Illinois was, you know, you would be driving along this corridor of corn, and, I mean, you really didn't know where you were. Other than that you were on the road, there was no landmark whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And if you weren't paying attention, you could have like a little, you know, daydream, and then all of a sudden miss where you were supposed to turn because you just went right by it because there's no street signs.
Right.
There's no
right. You know, but talk to us a little bit about what you're doing with your school. Take about a minute or two to tell us what you're doing with your school right now, because this is pretty fascinating.
So Blackburn, where all this stuff happened, was is still very near and dear to me. I'll keep it short. I flunked out of the college because I basically had. I was too young. 17 is, I think, too young to go to college, but ultimately went back and graduated with my class, which took a lot of work. They have a program there, a work program, where all of us worked. So when I started there, I worked in the theater 15 hours a week. I later became a plumber and ultimately started working on building a building. Now, when I say building a building, I'm talking about 18,000 square foot addition to a gymnasium with a Olympic-sized swimming pool and racquetball courts and lockers and offices. And it was all built by students. And it's really pretty amazing. And I have stayed in touch. I have gone back for homecomings. And back in probably about 2008, was invited to become a member of the board of trustees of the college. I've gotten back involved in that manner, and it's been wonderful to do. Colleges, small colleges, I think, especially provide an amazing experience for people.
They do.
And you know, Blackburn, the education you get, you know, both the academic education and then the experiential benefits are just astounding.
Yeah. No, I mean, college is a magnificent experience. And, you know, some people believe, well, everybody doesn't have to go to college. And that's basically true. But, you know, college is an experience like none other. I retired a few years ago. You know, Rico knows that. You know that. And I still have the energy. So I still teach an occasional course. I'm teaching one this semester. But sometimes I'm really just perplexed about the system of education, of learning, and that's really the antithesis of what you're talking about, because you're talking about great stuff with students. You're talking about wonderful things about learning in every conceivable sense of the word. But I do know this. You know the song, Sam Cooke's great 1959 song, which we're going to play later, What a Wonderful World. Don't know much about history. Don't know much about biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. Well, what I have learned, and one of the reasons I retired, frankly, is that I've reached the point where I think we can start taking that literally, including one and two. You know, in other words, a lot of students don't know anything about history or biology. Life is changing, and it's not fun. I remember, you know, the story that I told at the Moth a number of years ago, true story. 6 years ago, I'm teaching in the summer, teach every summer, and it's June, and I'm getting ready for school, and I'm going up to the Starbucks, doing what I always do, order a non-fat vanilla latte. And I'm the only one there. This is important for listeners to know. I'm the only one in the Starbucks, the only one. Nobody else is there. Nobody's there with their laptops, their phone. I'm waiting in line. I'm standing in line. I'm ordering. And the young man asks, okay, what is your name? I said, well, I'm the only one here. Why would you need to know my name? And he said, well, it's what we do. So I said, okay, Mick Jagger. And he looks at me with a straight face and he says, sir, we only need the first name. I said, okay, Mick. So a few moments later, you know, I get my drink and the young lady says, Mick, screams it like there's a bunch of people in the room. Well, that was eye-opening, to say the least. But more was revealed later that day when I met my allergist. It must have been a errand day. So I'm at my allergist and I come out of the office. And the woman there, very formal, very polite, says, Dr. Rubinchak, you need to come back 6 months from now for your testing, your allergy testing. And she looks at the book and she says, that would be December 7th. And I break open my FDR imitation, right? Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. And she looks at me and says, did you just make that up? I said, no. Now, look, I don't want anybody to misunderstand me. I'm not an old man, old bitter man who thinks that learning this stuff is it. I'm not believing that, because frankly, I think it's important to know how to change a tire, to be able to open up the hood of a car and can name at least three parts. It's really important to be able to fix things, to be handy, to do that. You know, my wife is brilliant, a brilliant musician, and she could fix anything. I really envy her. It's important to be able to do that. It really, really is. But I have to tell you, it's also important to know when the Civil War is fought, because when I asked a bunch of kids that not too long ago, the answer was a long time ago, okay? Or I would ask them, what year was it when JFK was assassinated? They wanted to know who JFK was, and what do you mean he was assassinated, right? I remember the question, who was Abraham Lincoln's vice president? And one kid, honest to God, looks at me and said, that's a trick question, because he didn't have any. I said, okay, no problem. So sometimes you really start asking yourself, at what point do we have to really understand the power of simply learning stuff, right? Rico, you were nodding. I mean, it's important to know things, right? And you understand that. You understand that. I wanted to share a story that our co-host and good friend Eric Heen told that same night. And this is just a poignant story, which is a little off the beaten path, but I really have to read this because I think it's wonderful, and it's about learning. It's about learning, okay? That's the theme of this story. It's entitled, My Friend Across the Fence. For a 12-year-old boy growing up in a religious Montana prairie town, I thought this would be interesting because small town, right? Sex was a forbidden monster knocking at the door. So the day I was at my friend Frankie's house, and we happened to across the book called The Joy of Sex, I felt like I had just won the lottery. And as we ruffled through the sacred pages, I was delighted to see it even contained pictures, most notably pictures of female body parts. Even the sounds of the words made me quiver, words like vulva. I didn't know what was happening to me, but I felt that I was on the brink of a life-changing discovery. Eventually, we came across a chapter called Homosexuality. Now, I'd vaguely heard of this concept, and it seemed to throw everything out of whack. I looked at Frankie and thought, would I ever want to do anything in this book with Frankie? After pondering that for a moment, I thought, hell no. I didn't want Frankie or any other boy for that matter. I much preferred the vulvas. Well, after I went home that day, I thought a lot about that book, and a week later I returned to Frankie's house, begging to borrow it. And after he reluctantly agreed, I smuggled it home and snuck it up into my attic to read it. But after opening it, I noticed all the pages were bent and worn in the homosexuality section, with the rest of the book still looking quite new. It puzzled me why Frankie was more interested in that section. But I shrugged it off. In the days that followed, I noticed Frankie was often lost in thought, as if he were harboring a secret he didn't want anybody else to know. And as time went on, it became apparent that Frankie was different than the rest of the boys in our town. It was a small town, and we could tell. Most of us loved to play hockey and football and go hunting and fishing, but Frankie preferred to stay home and do artwork, which he did exceedingly well. Despite the differences, Frankie and I were inseparable friends. He had so many deep ideas about life, we could sit down and talk about it for hours, and I really valued his friendship and couldn't imagine life without him. By the time we got into high school, the other boys were calling Frankie a homo behind his back. At first, I defended him and tried to reassure anyone that Frankie liked girls as much as we did. But one day, two older boys approached me, and one said, "You know, the way you keep defending Frankie, we think you might be a homo, too." Well, in that small town, in that day and age, being accused of that was an ultimate sin, and it was like being condemned to hell. I soon buckled under peer pressure and resolved to have nothing to do with Frankie. Finally, he confronted me and asked, "What's going on, man? We were the best of friends. Why are you avoiding me?" I looked at Frankie in the eye and, mustering up all the defiance I could, said, "Frankie, it's because I'm a real man and you're a queer." Frankie stared at me until I had to look away, and then he walked off with another just blank stare, just not another word. After that day, Frankie was pretty much friendless. He mostly kept to himself and did his artwork, and meanwhile I'd play hockey and go hunting and fishing with the other boys, but I felt something vital was missing from my life. Nevertheless, I couldn't risk being seen or associated with Frankie. After graduating from high school, I joined the Army and served for 3 years until 1982. On my first day back in my hometown, I ran across Frankie's sister, Jill. She said Frankie had moved to Seattle to become an artist. She also said there was a weird new virus going around and that the men in Frankie's community all seemed to be catching it, and they were dying. She told me that she was quite sure Frankie had it too. I stood there feeling numb, thinking about all those countless hours I'd spent with Frankie and how deeply I treasured his friendship. And most of all, I anguished over the moment that I rejected him. And then Jill said, "You know, I think Frankie wouldn't mind it if you were to give him a call." And she gave me his phone number. I went home and the days went by. I kept inventing lame excuses for not calling Frankie. Then finally, I couldn't stand it anymore, and I called my old friend. Frankie's voice was weak, but as soon as he started talking, tons of memories came flooding back to me. And right then, he wasn't gay Frankie. That didn't matter anymore. He was my childhood friend Frankie, plain and simple. Toward the end of our conversation, I started trying to apologize for being such an a-hole to him, but Frankie cut me off and said, "It's not you, Eric. It's the world. The world won't let two guys on different sides of the fence just reach across and be friends." And after a pause, he said, "But why not? Tell me, why not?" Well, in the next couple of months, I talked to Frankie a few more times, but before I could see him, Jill called to say Frankie had just died of AIDS. And then she said something I'll never forget. She said Frankie told her that when he and I reconnected, he felt a missing part of his life had just been restored, and it was one of the best days of his life. Ever since then, if I meet a guy who happens to be gay and I want to be his friend, I just reach across that fence to be his friend. And when I do, I have a feeling that somewhere out there, Frankie is smiling down on me. You know, I know we didn't cover everything we wanted to that night, but I had to tell that story. Because we talk about college, we talk about great experiences. We talk about girls, we talk about smiles, we talk about condoms, we talk about roommates. We talk about good professors, bad professors, we talk about things we've learned, we talk about when the Civil War was fought, we talk about it all, but we sometimes forget about those kind of lessons. Rico, I don't want to put you on the spot, I really don't, but you know, you've gone to school and you've been in two of my classes, and I know you were kind of nodding when you heard that story. It's a mm-hmm. good story, right?
Yeah, definitely.
What's one thing that you learned in college that has nothing to do with subject matter, nothing to do with facts and figures, that really made an indelible impression on you?
I had always thought of authority as being something gained without merit mm-hmm. For the most part, and college kind of taught me that that's mostly true, and it doesn't have to affect you as much as it was affecting me. I was always fighting back and pushing back against the man, but college kind of gave me that patience. It told me, you know, not everything has to be a fight. You don't have to take it upon you to rectify these wrongs. And you know, I became a more patient and empathetic man after that.
Well, actually, that's pretty damn insightful. That is a really great, great insight. And with all due respect, it usually takes people a lot older than you to figure that one out. So what do you do? What do you do when you find yourself feeling combative or aggressive? What do you do to just kind of get out of your body for a moment, float up to the ceiling and say, "I'm going to take this action instead"? What do you do instead?
I get the biggest plastic bag of drugs I can find now. But you know,
right, the coke that
the Coca-Cola,
right, the coke that Paul was trying to get out of the machine,
right,
didn't work. Yeah,
if we're being completely honest and candid, you know, I had to take therapy to kind of get through that, because I really did think it was me versus the world, and you know, the therapy helped, but to actually put it in practice mm-hmm. was a completely different beast.
Yeah,
and you can't when you're younger, you can get away with fighting back, but as you get older, the consequences start to ramp up pretty viciously. And so, you know, I had to weigh my options. I had to pick my battles, and all that came with sometimes swallowing my pride.
Yeah. Good for you. Really articulate. Thank you, man. I thank you. And I do appreciate it because there's no script here. Rico just really rattled that one off brilliantly. I wanted to just change the subject for a second, but stay with education. Paul, you've always been active with exchange students, right?
Yes, yeah.
And absolutely. I know we just have about a minute left, but you can get some for us later in the year because I really want to get some on.
Absolutely.
We've had some exchange students here who have offered some incredible observations about culture and about ethnicity and about diversity and about inclusion, you know, all of these words that we think about. And, you know, even they have these marvelous anecdotes and notions about the use of even pronouns, right? The use of pronouns.
Well, they see things that we don't see oftentimes.
They really
or they
do.
See things that are to us commonplace that to them are not. And the beautiful thing about them is they question it. We see these things and we don't question it. But I can definitely arrange that. We've got another group of kids here this year, and they're pretty interesting.
Yeah, I love talking to them. I really love talking to them. And, you know, I just mentioned the word pronouns, and it kind of, I don't know how everybody feels about this. I don't mind referring to students as pronouns. I just want to make sure they can use one in a sentence. And frankly, we've had a hard time. Yeah, I'm just all these quick jokes tonight, I know. I mean, you know, some people just think a pronoun is a noun that gets paid to be in a sentence. I mean, I don't know, right? There's all sorts of things going on, right? Rico, what do you think? Hey, talk about the show that you do.
Okay, I guess I get a free plug.
You better believe it.
Well, thank you, Doc. I host a show on HD2 on kpft.org, and I kind of do something a little different from, you know, the blues, the country, and it's house music. I used to DJ in the clubs here in Houston downtown, and it was a great time, and it was a good time after COVID especially, and I've settled down a little bit, but I DJ house music. It's called The Housestonian every Monday at 9 p.m., feel free to listen to it and get some chores done.
All righty. All right. Beautiful. HD2. Yeah. And don't forget, HD2 does exist.
Yeah.
A lot of our listeners say, what's HD2? It's a whole other station, a whole new gig. Thank you, Paul Topikian, for teaching us something special and how the power of story not only stretches the boundary of the human heart, but also the mind. And thank you, Rico Enriquez, for being my engineer, friend, and loyal KPFT veteran. You know, I mentioned the Sam Cooke song a little bit earlier, right? Don't Know Much. Well, there's no better way to end this one, right? Sammy Cooke, 1959, Boomers, What a Wonderful World. Don't even think about going away, because Living Art, hosted by Michael Woodson, is going to be around here just in a moment. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And be sure to join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for So What's Your Story? You keep loving a great one, and we're going to keep bringing these stories to you. This is Dr. Hank, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't end happily, it doesn't mean you can't live happily ever after. Peace. But I don't know what it was to. And if this one could be with you, what a wonderful world this would be. Now, I don't claim to be an A student, but I'm trying to be. For maybe by being an A student, baby, I can win your love for me. Don't know much about history, don't know much biology, don't know much about a science book, don't know much about the French I took, but I do know that I love you, and I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. La ta 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 ta. Science book, French
KPFT, Houston.